So before I kind of begin talking about what we're talking about today, I just wanted to say finding that stack of Bibles reminded me of a story from a colleague at another UU church. And somebody came and wanted to look something up in the Bible, and everyone in the office started looking at each other and said, "Bible? We have a Bible?" Sort of appreciated the irony of a church and no Bibles, but we found them this morning. And in fact, we found them in our library that Ed Chabron is our librarian over in the community room. We have a lot of books on the topic that I'm going to be talking about this morning, these non-canonical gospels and other books that aren't found in the Bible. So if you are interested, there's a nice selection over there as well. But let's talk a little bit this morning about the New Testament. We typically call it the Christian Scriptures in a UU setting, because we identify the Hebrew Scriptures and the Christian Scriptures rather than looking at it through the Christian lens of Old and New Testament. There's 27 books within the Christian Scriptures, and those books were created in the centuries after Jesus' death. Leaders of various churches began arguing over which of the many gospel texts that were circulating at the time contained the truth, with a capital T. Was Jesus a human philosopher? That's what the Unitarians of the time believed. Or the equal of God? Did people naturally have the ability to be good? That's what the Universalists of the time believed. Or was good the result of beliefs in a particular supernatural narrative? The gospels that made their way into the canon as we know it are familiar to many of us. Stories of Jesus as the divine Savior, Mary Magdalene as the redeemed fallen woman, Judas as the betrayer. But in the rejected Gospels, we find other stories. Stories of the power of women, of the inherent strength of the human spirit, of the complexity of the relationship between good and evil. Come as we journey into three of these rejected Gospels.
The Gospel of Mary. After the Savior said these things, he departed from them. But the disciples were distressed and wept greatly. "How are we going to go out into the rest of the world to announce the good news about the child of true humanity?" they said. "They did not spare him. How will they spare us?" Then Mary stood up. She greeted them all, addressing her brothers and sisters. "Do not weep and be distressed, for he has prepared us and made us true human beings." When Mary had said these things, she turned their heart toward their God, toward the good, and they began to debate about the words of the Savior. Peter said to Mary, "Sister, we know that the Savior loved you more than all other women. Tell us the words of the Savior that you remember, the things which you know that we don't." Mary responded, "I will teach you about what is hidden from you."
Achmin, Egypt, 1895. Hidden in a niche, in a wall, in a burial site, a papyrus book is found, dating to early 5th century. Alongside other rejected gospels, its contents include a fragment of the Gospel of Mary. Now, scholars believe this is the story of Mary Magdalene. And almost 90 years later, in 1983, another piece is discovered and published. Hope remains that yet another fragment will emerge from deep within a cave or underground tomb. In the fragments we do have of the Gospel of Mary, one we heard just now, it is Mary, not any of the male disciples, who is able to fully comprehend the wisdom of Jesus. Rather than focusing on his bodily pain and death as the source of salvation, the Gospel of Mary relates the importance of an interior sense of goodness. "The Son of Man is within you," Jesus says in this text, indicative of our Unitarian tradition of divinity within each of us. Another verse says, "Good came into your being to the essence of every nature in order to restore it to its root." This is in true universalist fashion. It suggests that the way to salvation and wholeness rests within each person already. To regain one's inherent goodness requires overcoming the evils of the world. After Jesus departs, leaving the male disciples baffled, it is only Mary who is able to effectively unpack and articulate this radical spiritual message. The male disciples are like, what? Initially, the disciples refuse to believe Mary, and I can't help but think of the current publicity around the sexual misconduct of powerful men when Mary asks, do you think I thought this up by myself or that I am lying? She weeps, an indicator of necessary vulnerability, a soft strength, if you will, something needed to get in touch with his teachings, something the male disciples don't have. Levi speaks out in Mary's defense, scolding those who would reject a woman's wisdom, especially considering that Jesus himself, quote, loved her more than us. The disciples are moved by this and go out to preach the gospel, not laying down any other rule or law beyond what the Savior said. In other words, their central focus becomes these ethical teachings of Jesus, how to be in the world, as opposed to supernatural-based religious rules. Scholar Karen L. King astutely writes that history is written by the winners. For Christianity, that has meant that many voices in these debates were silenced through repression or neglect. It's quite telling that this once widely circulated gospel, with its potential Unitarian, Universalist, and feminist overtones, did not find its way into the canon. For patriarchy, it was threatening. The authority of the female voice suggests that women could hold a level of intellectual understanding superior to men. Who would have thought, right? Is it coincidence that Mary Magdalene is popularly thought of as a prostitute, when the reality is that there is no biblical text that concretely says as much? Or is this simply part of an age-old cultural process to shame and discredit the voices of powerful women? I'll let you answer that. The Gospel of Mary suggests that territory traditionally considered feminine, vulnerability, emotionality, are actually strengths that allow a deeper understanding of the spiritual. This is the true path to salvation, as opposed to the traditionally masculine focus on rules, laws, and bodily concerns. The message is not that Mary is superior to the male disciples. It is that Mary's attributes as a woman place her in a position of being able to receive this particular saving, salvific message more easily than the male disciples can. This might be what patriarchy would have considered most dangerous about this ultimately rejected text. For Mary Magdalene must be considered the true disciple.
Words from the Gospel of Thomas. These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke, and which Didymus Judas Thomas wrote down. And he said, whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings will not experience death.
December 1945. While digging for soil to fertilize crops, an Arab peasant found a red earthenware jar near Nag Hammadi, a city in Upper Egypt. His fear of uncorking an evil spirit or genie was shortly overcome by the hope of finding treasure within. And there was treasure within, as far as scholars and historians were concerned anyway. Inside the jar were 13 leather-bound papyrus books dating from approximately 350 CE. And the Gospel of Thomas was among them. So what is it? It is a collection of 114 sayings of Jesus. No narrative, just quotations. One-third of the sayings in the Gospel of Thomas can be found in the Gospels of Luke, Matthew, and Mark, and another one-third can be found in the Gospel of John, indicating that all of these books were likely made from the same shared source document. So why was the Gospel of Thomas rejected? The answer is in the remaining third of those sayings, sayings found in no other gospel in the biblical canon. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you have will save you. If you do not have that within you, what you do not have within you will kill you. In other words, divinity is located within the human being. Salvation is within ourselves. The cultivation of goodness is within us rather than outside of us, and so is evil. Contrast this to the Gospels of Mark, Matthew, and Luke, all of which essentially say that it is accepting the external reality of Jesus that is important to salvation, not a divine spark of goodness within each of us. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, "I am the light that is over all things. I am all." Well, that kind of sounds familiar, but let's let it go a little further. "From me all came forth, and to me all attained. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up a stone, and you will find me there." Note again that the spark of divinity is already in all things. This divine light shines through all beings, and it's even in a piece of wood or a rock. Humans can gain access to this light when we look for it, when we exercise our Unitarian Universalist fourth principle of searching for truth and meaning. And since we all have this divine light, we are all connected. Contrast this with the Gospel of John from the canon itself, which was written later than Thomas, where the question is asked, "How do you find the light?" And John answers, "Only through Jesus." Also in the Gospel of John, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. My followers won't ever have to walk in the dark. No, they'll have the real light." See the difference? In John, only Jesus is the light. Humanity doesn't have it. Salvation comes through belief in him as the way, the truth, and the light. The Gospel of Thomas says that Jesus is not necessarily the only way. After all, we all carry the light within us, and it connects us. We get in touch with this light by connecting to the good within ourselves. Sounds very Unitarian Universalist, right? As Reverend Dr. Linda Anderson says, that John was canonized and Thomas was not had huge implications for Christianity and for Unitarian Universalism. By canonizing John, God became primarily transcendent, beyond humanity. Humans have no agency to save themselves. It all comes through God. This philosophy put Christianity on a path of looking to God rather than within the human heart. Our job is to believe. God does the rest. There's not a lot of room here for doubt or questioning or beliefs in other ways. In a religiously pluralistic world, the idea that the beliefs of one religious system, be it Christian, Jewish, Islamic, Hindu, or Buddhist, the beliefs of one religious system are an exclusive path to a better world, well, that's an idea that has increased the levels of intolerance, war, and destruction in the world. And so this is where we see the great loss that has come from the rejection of these so-called lost gospels. Suppressed is more like it. In the quest for the exclusive truth, we miss out on the complexity of holding multiple truths at once, of exploring and discovering truth and meaning for ourselves. By withholding wisdom, we pave the way for ignorance and lack of accountability. In other words, that light we've been talking about, we snuff it out. From centuries past, humanity has searched for truth and meaning. Whether from Egypt of ancient times to this moment of our modern world, we have looked to understand our lives in all of their complexity. And they are complex indeed. Not a day goes by when each of us isn't touched by life's surprises, both joyful and sorrowful. And we heard some of those spoken earlier today. Not a day goes by when each of us isn't reminded of the preciousness of life and our own mortality. Though sometimes we miss those reminders amidst the hurly-burly of our lives, the din of debate, the noise of all the voices that surround us. And sometimes, deep in the caves of forgotten places and times, we discover ourselves. Reflections look back at us. Who we are, who we were, who we could be. what to do with those reflections, how to take truth and drive it into purpose. These are our struggles. May we remember that the wisdom of old is also the wisdom of the new. Loss and pain and struggle are not new, though they greet us as new time and again. May we never forget the places of knowledge we have explored before. May we listen to the voices of the ancients with new ears.
Judas. Jesus said to Judas, "Come, that I may teach you about secrets no person has ever seen. For there exists a great and boundless realm whose extent no generation of angels has seen, in which there is a great invisible spirit, which no eye of an angel has ever seen, no thought of the heart has ever comprehended, and it was never called by any name."
What an invitation, huh? Who could resist that call to be taught secrets no person has ever seen? 1972, the Gospel of Judas was found near Beni Mazar. Written in Coptic around 280 CE, and experts believe it was translated into Coptic from an earlier original in Greek. Judas is, of course, the infamous disciple who betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, setting in motion the events that lead to the crucifixion. Overcome with guilt, Judas hangs himself, his name becoming synonymous with betrayal, evil, and shame. But the rejected Gospel of Judas tells a different story. Though near the beginning, Judas himself recounts a vision, a dream that he has. In the vision, it says, "I saw myself as the 12 disciples were stoning me and persecuting me severely." "Not to worry," Jesus says, "for Judas is indeed a singular disciple. You will exceed them all," he says. Now, according to biblical canon, Satan whispered in Judas's ear, telling him to go betray Jesus. But in the Gospel of Judas, it is Jesus who whispers in Judas's ear, instructing him in what he is to do in order to release Jesus from his human form. It is Judas who must betray Jesus. Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us that Judas was acting on his own selfish behalf and turning Jesus over to the authorities, that Satan had entered him. But the Gospel of Judas paints Judas's actions as a necessary part of a larger plan. So what use is this rejected gospel to a modern Unitarian Universalist? Now, it's common knowledge what it means to be a Judas, but most of us don't spend too much time thinking about Judas one way or another. I know I don't. Yet we can argue that while mainstream Christian culture has reviled Judas for 2,000 years, it's also kept the narrative that the crucifixion was part of a divine plan. So how do you reconcile that? Isn't that a contradiction then to vilify Judas when it was he who actually moves that plan forward? The Gospel of Judas changes Judas from a mere betrayer, a superficial villain to boo and hiss at, into someone acting as part of a larger, greater, more complex plan. There are no villains or bad guys in the Gospel of Judas. There is only the complexity of connection. There are only people living out their roles for complicated reasons, reasons that are not always obvious by their actions. Not too long ago, I needed to meet with someone I have struggled with in my personal life. Our conversations seem to dwell on the negative. We rarely see eye to eye, and I find myself feeling wronged and defensive when we're together. Maybe you have someone like this in your life, right? I hope you don't have too many people like that. "He's probably already waiting for me at the restaurant," I moaned to our office administrator, Rita. Rita looked at me and said, "Go on, go meet your guru." If we look at this through the Judas lens, then she is right. This person who was my enemy is also indeed my teacher. Now, I didn't consciously sign up for this class. We're all in a larger class right now in our country, right, that we didn't necessarily sign up for. But who's to say why there is so much struggle in our interactions? The opportunity to switch the lens from thinking of him as my enemy to a teacher is one that opens up new possibilities for me. It gives me the opportunity to ask why this person is so challenging for me to be around. What is it that makes me feel attacked? How can I take these moments of conflict and gain insight beyond the simple story of hero, and that was me, versus villain, that was him, that I had been telling myself? The Gospel of Judas invites us into this space of ambiguity. Rejected by the canon in part because its complicated Judas character conflicted with the canon's portrayal of him as a mere villain, this text invites us to consider the Judases in our own lives. Our villains, our enemies, our gurus, our teachers. Not quite 2 weeks ago now, I flipped open my laptop to check my email. The headline read, "Two Dead in Kentucky School Shooting." Oh, I thought. Well, I better get on to checking my email. I'm waiting to hear back from... And then I stopped myself. The horror I had felt watching the coverage of the Columbine High School shooting on television 19 years ago washed over me. I remembered how unbelievable each of those details had seemed. The black-clad high schoolers stalking through the hallways with assault weapons. It had seemed to take place somewhere outside of reality. I could barely grapple with it at the time. The shooting in Kentucky? Barely was a blip across my mind before I turned back to everyday matters. The truth is that information from that Columbine shooting is readily available through an internet search. We haven't lost the thousands, if not millions, of words written about it. Unlike the gospel texts we have explored this morning, information about this tragedy is not buried in caves or hidden in walled-over niches in ancient churches. But my question is, do we bury wisdom in our hearts and minds, especially when it becomes too hard to bear? I chose the particular three Gospels this morning because they show us where humanity was and where we are now. The Gospel of Mary was suppressed because it showed women as an authoritative voice. The Gospel of Thomas was suppressed because it said salvation came from cultivating the goodness already within you rather than relying on an external God. The Gospel of Judas was suppressed because it complexified evil. All ideas our ancestors were willing to bury so they wouldn't have to think about them, so they didn't have to question the status quo. And I wonder... Oh, I wonder what ideas we are burying today. What don't we want to consider? The fourth principle of Unitarian Universalism calls us to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Emphasis on responsible. We struggle with truth today, from finger-pointing about fake news to the question of alternative facts. We wonder if the concept of truth is disappearing. And meaning-making, historically the heart of healthy religious life, has become eclipsed by the embrace of rigidity and dogma. And so here we are, all of us in this room who probably subscribe to this principle of truth and meaning, and yet we too are still vulnerable to forgetting old truths. When I reacted as I did to the Kentucky shooting, I didn't even realize that I had buried old wisdom and meaning on that subject. These rejected gospels remind us of humanity's tendency to pick and choose reality, to seek to destroy the ideas that make us uncomfortable and forget the wisdom that encourages us to grow. For we know that growth is often painful. But as any of us, and is there anyone in this room who hasn't been through something painful in our lives, whether it was the loss of someone close to us, whether it was deep disappointment that comes from an unfulfilled goal or dream, whatever it was, we have all experienced pain. And when we have enough distance from it, when we often can see the places we have grown from that pain. I said before that I wouldn't be here if my mother-in-law's death had not been so prolonged and painful. I was never called to this work of ministry because I wanted to be a minister, in the same way someone might want to be an architect or teacher. I didn't. Believe it or not, I'm not particularly comfortable being in the public eye. And I know a lot of the things I do would not necessarily support that, but I don't naturally think of myself as someone whose opinion is worth sharing. But that painful time of caregiving connected me with the preciousness of life, what it means to care for others in both the micro and the macro sense, and I ultimately felt called to expand the way I cared for others, even as I knew I was setting myself up for a losing game, for we can never do enough, I can never do enough, the need is always greater than one person or 200. But I'm so glad I didn't hide that truth and meaning away just because it's one I still have to wrestle with. And I'll be honest with you, I do, on a daily basis. For I would have missed out on being part of a community like this one, of knowing people like you, of doing the precious, life-affirming, impossible work that we do. And I say impossible because even as I decided to share the story of the Kentucky shooting with you, yet another school shooting appeared on my newsfeed. So my invitation to you is this: to consider whether there are any lost gospels in your own lives, whether there are pieces of truth and meaning that you have buried somewhere, whether there is a midnight black cave you need to explore to discover something you may have lost, whether there is a greater search for truth out in the world that you can be part of, whether there is something that we as a community, as a country, can do to remind people of who we are, who we were, and what may have been lost somewhere in that translation. I don't have the answers to any of this, really. These lost or rejected gospels are buried somewhere within you individually and within us collectively, and the work to find them must be done both ways, alone and together. And so, I invite us to continue to do that work. For as long as there is human will and hope, human energy and bravery, and both human brokenness and, when we choose to search for it, human wholeness, then there is indeed hope.